Track 8.
It's international person-to-person, called Samantha's assistant. And Samantha's pulse raced. Instantly forgotten was the host of spiral cone sea snails. Nicholas, she shouted happily, spilled half a pint of seawater down the Australian's trouser leg and ran wildly to the small cubicle at the end of the laboratory. She was breathless with excitement as she snatched up the receiver, and she pressed one hand against her heart to stop it thumping. Is that Dr. Silver? Yes, it's me. Then correcting her grammar, it is she. Go ahead, please, said the operator. And there was a click and pulse on the line as it came alive. Oh, Nicholas, she exulted. Darling Nicholas, is that you? No. The voice was very clear and serene, as though the speaker stood beside her, and it was familiar, disconcertingly so. And for no good reason, Samantha felt her heart shrink with dread. This is Chantelle Alexander, Peter's mother. We have met briefly. Yes. Samantha's voice was now small and still breathless. I thought it would be kind to tell you in person, before you hear from other sources, that Nicholas and I have decided to remarry. Samantha sat down jerkily on the office stool. Are you there? Chantelle asked after a moment. I don't believe you, whispered Samantha. I'm sorry, Chantelle told her gently. But there is Peter, you see, and we have rediscovered each other. Discovered that we had never stopped loving each other. Nicholas wouldn't. Her voice broke, and she could not go on. You must understand and forgive him, my dear, Chantelle explained. After our divorce, he was hurt and lonely. I'm sure he did not mean to take advantage of you. But we were supposed to... We were going to... I know. Please believe me, this has not been easy for any of us. For all our sakes. We had planned a whole life together. Samantha shook her head wildly, and a thick skein of golden hair came loose and flopped into her face, and she pushed it back with a combing gesture. I don't believe it. Why didn't Nicholas tell me himself? I won't believe it until he tells me. Chantelle's voice was compassionate, gentle. I so wanted not to make it ugly for you, my child. But now, what I can do, but tell you that Nicholas spent last night in my house, in my bed, in my arms, where he truly belongs. It was almost miraculous, a physical thing. But sitting hunched on the hard, round stool, Samantha Silver felt her youth fall away from her, sloughed off like a glittering reptilian skin. She was left with the sensation of timelessness, possessed of all the suffering and sorrow of every woman who'd ever lived before. She felt very old and wise and sad. And she lifted her fingers and touched her own cheek, mildly surprised to feel that the skin was not dried and withered like that of some ancient crone. I've already made the arrangements for a divorce from my present husband, and Nicholas will resume his position at the head of Christy Marine. It was true. Samantha knew then that it was true. There was no question, no doubt. And slowly, she replaced the receiver of the telephone and sat staring blankly at the bare wall of the cubicle. She did not cry. She felt as though she would never cry, nor laugh again in her life. Chantelle Alexander studied her husband carefully, trying to stand outside herself and see him dispassionately. She found it easier now that the giddy insanity had burned away. He was a handsome man, tall and lean, with those carefully groomed metallic waves of coppery hair. Even the wrist that he shot from the crisp white cuff of his sleeve was covered with those fine gleaming hairs. She knew so well that even his lean chest was covered with thick golden curls, crisp and curly as fresh lettuce leaves. She had never been attracted by smooth, hairless men. "May I smoke?" he asked, and she inclined her head. His voice had always attracted her from the first, deep and resonant, but with those high-bred accents, the gentle softening of the vowel sounds, the lazy drawling of consonants. The voice and the patrician manner were things that she had been trained to appreciate, and yet, under the mannered, cultivated exterior, was the flash of exciting wickedness that showed in the wolfish white gleam of smile and the sharp, glittering grey steel of his gaze. He lit the custom-made cigarette with the gold lighter she had given him, her very first gift, the night they'd become lovers. Even now, the memory of it was piquant, and for a moment she felt the soft, melting warmth of her lower belly, and she stirred restlessly in her chair. There had been reason, and good reason for that madness. And even now it was over, she would never regret it. It had been a period in her life which she had not been able to deny herself. The grand, sweeping, illicit passion. The last flush of her youth. The final, careless autumn that preceded middle age. Another ordinary woman might have had to content herself with sweaty, sordid gropings and grapplings in anonymous hotel bedrooms. But not Chantelle Christie. Her world was shaped by her own whims and desires. And as she had told Nicholas, whatever she desired was hers to take. Long ago, her father had taught her that there were special rules for Chantelle Christie, and the rules were those she made herself. It had been marvellous. She shivered slightly at the lingering sensuality of those early days. But now it was over. During the past months, she had been carefully comparing the two men. Her decision had not been lightly made. She had watched Nicholas retrieve his life from the gulf of disaster. On his own, stripped naked of all but that invisible, indefinable mantle of strength and determination, he had fought his way back out of the gulf. Strength and power had always moved her, but she had, over the years, grown accustomed to Nicholas. Familiarity had staled their relationship for her. And now her interlude with Duncan had freshened her view of him, and he had for her all the novel appeal of a new lover, yet with the proven values and qualities of long, intimate acquaintance. Duncan Alexander was finished. Nicholas Berg was the future. But no, she would never regret this interlude in her life. It had been a time of rejuvenation. She would not even regret Nicholas's involvement with the pretty American child. Later, it would add a certain perverse spice to their own sexuality, she thought, and felt the shiver run down her thighs and the soft, secret stirring of her flesh, like the opening of a petaled rosebud. Duncan had taught her many things, bizarre little tricks of arousal, made more poignant by being forbidden and wicked. Unfortunately, Duncan relied almost entirely on the tricks, and not all of them had worked for her. The corners of her mouth turned down with distaste as she remembered. Perhaps it was just that which had begun the curdling process. No, Duncan Alexander had not been able to match her raw, elemental sexuality and soaring abandon. Only one man had ever been able to do that. Duncan had served a purpose, but now it was over. It might have dragged on a little longer, but Duncan Alexander had endangered Christy Marine. Never had she thought of that possibility. Christy Marine was a fact of her life, as vast and immutable as the heavens. But now, the foundations of heaven were being shaken. His sexual attraction had staled. She might have forgiven him that, but not the other. She became aware of Duncan's discomfort. He twisted sideways in his chair, crossing and uncrossing his long legs. And he rolled the cigarette between his fingers, studying the rising spiral of blue smoke to avoid the level, expressionless gaze of her dark, fathomless eyes. She had been staring at him, but seeing the other man. Now, with an effort, she focused her full attention on him. "Thank you for coming so promptly," she said. It did seem rather urgent. He smiled for the first time, glossy and urbane, but with fear down there in the cool grey eyes, and his tension was betrayed by the clenched sinew in the point of his jaw. Looking closely, as she had not done for many months, she saw how he was fined down. The long tapered fingers were bony and never still. There were new harder lines to his mouth and a frown to the set of his eyes. The skin at the corners cracked like oil paint into hundreds of fine wrinkles that the deep brown snow tan hid from a casual glance. Now he returned her scrutiny directly. "From what you told me yesterday..." She lifted her hand to stop him. "That can wait. I merely wanted to impress you with the seriousness of what is happening. What is really of prime importance now is what you have done with control of my shares and those of the trust." His hands went very still. "What does that mean?" "I want auditors, my appointed auditors, sent in." He shrugged. "All this will take time, Chantal, and I'm not certain that I'm ready to relinquish control." He was very cool, very casual now, and the fear was gone. She felt a stir of relief. Perhaps the horror story that Nicholas had told her was untrue. Perhaps the danger was imaginary only. Christy Marine was so big, so invulnerable. "Not just at the moment, anyway. You'd have to prove to me that doing so was in the best interest of the company and of the trust." "I don't have to prove anything to anyone," she said flatly. "This time you do. You have appointed me..." "No court of law would uphold that agreement." "Perhaps not, Chantal. But do you want to drag all this through the courts at a time like this?" "I'm not afraid, Duncan." She stood up quickly, light on her feet as a dancer, the lovely legs in loose black silk trousers, soft flat shoes making her seem still smaller, a slim gold chain emphasizing the narrowness of the tiny waist. "You know, I'm afraid of nothing." She stood over him and pointed the accuser's finger. The nails tipped in scarlet, the color of fresh arterial blood. "You should be the one to fear." "And precisely what is it you are accusing me of?" And she told him, reading off swiftly the lists of guarantees made by the trust, the transfer of shares and the issues of new shares and guarantees within the Christy Marine group of subsidiaries. She listed the known layering of underwriting cover on Golden Dawn that Nicholas had unearthed. "When my auditors have finished, Duncan, darling, Not only will the courts return control of Christy Marine to me, but they will probably sentence you to 5 years at hard labor. They take this sort of thing rather seriously, you know. He smiled. He actually smiled. She felt her fury seething to the surface, and the set of her eyes altered. Color tinted the smooth, pale olive of her cheeks. "You dare to grin at me," she hissed. "I will break you for that." "No." He shook his head. "No, you won't. Are you denying?" She snapped, but he cut her off with a raised hand and a shake of that handsome, arrogant head. "I'm denying nothing, my love. On the contrary, I'm going to admit it. And more. Much more." He flicked the cigarette away, and it hissed sharply in the lapping blue wavelets of the yacht basin. While she stared at him, struck speechless, he let the silence play out like a skilled actor as he selected and lit another cigarette from the gold case. For some weeks now, I've been fully aware that somebody was prying very deeply into my affairs and those of the company. He blew a long blue feather of cigarette smoke and cocked one eyebrow at her, a cynical, mocking gesture which increased her fury but left her feeling suddenly afraid and uncertain. It didn't take long to establish that the trace was coming from a little man in Monte Carlo who makes a living at financial and industrial espionage. Lazarus is good. Excellent, the very best. I have used him myself. In fact, it was I who introduced him to Nicholas Berg. He chuckled then, shaking his head indulgently. The silly things we do sometimes. The connection was immediate. Berg and Lazarus. I have run my own check on what they have come up with, and I estimate that even Lazarus could not have uncovered more than 25% of the answers. He leaned forward, and suddenly his voice snapped with a new authority. You see, Chantel, dear, I am probably one of the best in the world myself. They could never have traced it all. You are not denying, then? She heard the faltering tone in her own voice and hated herself for it. He brushed her aside contemptuously. Be quiet, you silly little woman, and listen to me. I'm going to tell you just how deeply you are in. I'm going to explain to you, in terms that even you can understand, why you will not send in your auditors, why you will not fire me, and why you will do exactly what I tell you to do. He paused and stared into her eyes, a direct trial of strength which she could not meet. She was confused and uncertain, for once not in control of her own destiny. She dropped her eyes, and he nodded with satisfaction. Very well. Now listen. I have put it all, everything that is Christy Marine. It is all riding on Golden Dawn. Chantel felt the earth turn giddily under her feet and the sudden roaring rush of blood in her ears. She stepped back, and the stone parapet caught the back of her knees. She sat down heavily. "What are you talking about?" she whispered. And he told her, in substantial detail, from the beginning, how it had worked out. From the laying of Golden Dawn's keel in the times of vast tanker tonnage demand. My calculations were based on demand for tanker space 2 years ago and on construction costs at that time. The energy crisis and collapse in demand for tankers had come with the vicious rise in inflation, bloating the costs of construction of Golden Dawn by more than double. Duncan had countered by altering the design of the gigantic tanker. He had reduced the four propulsion units to one, He had cut down the steel structuring of the hull reinforcement by 20%. He had done away with the elaborate safety functions and fail-safe systems designed by Nicholas Berg, and he had cut it too fine. He had forfeited the A1 Lloyd's rating, the mark of approval from the inspectors of that venerable body. Without the insurance backing of that huge underwriting market, he had been forced to look elsewhere to find the cover to satisfy his financiers. The premiums had been crippling. He had to pledge Christie Marine stock, the trust stock. Then the spiraling cost of production had overtaken him again, and he needed money and more money. He had taken it where he could find it, at rates of interest that were demanded, and used more Christie stock as collateral. Then the insurance cover had been insufficient to cover the huge increase in the cost of the ultra-tanker's hull. When luck runs out... Duncan shrugged eloquently and went on. I had to pledge more Christie stock. All of it. It's all at risk, Chantel. Every single piece of paper, even the shares we retrieved from your Nicholas, and even that wasn't enough. I've had to write cover through front companies, cover that is worthless. Then, Duncan smiled again, relaxed and unruffled, almost as though he was enjoying himself. Then there was that awful fiasco when Golden Adventurer went up on the ice, and I had to find $6 million to pay the salvage award. That was the last of it. I went out for everything then, all of it. The trust. The whole of Christie Marie. I'll break you, she whispered. I'll smash you. I swear before God. You don't understand, do you? He shook his head sorrowfully, as though at an obtuse child. You cannot break me without breaking Christie Marie and yourself. You are in it, Chantel, much, much deeper than I am. You have everything, every penny, this house, that emerald on your finger, the future of your brat, all of it riding on Golden Dawn. No. She closed her eyes very tightly, and there was no color in her cheeks now. Yes, I'm afraid it's yes, he contradicted. I didn't plan it that way. I saw a profit of 200 millions in it, but we've been... caught up in circumstances, I'm afraid. They were both silent, and Chantel swayed slightly as the full enormity of it overwhelmed her. If you whistle up your hounds now, if you call in your axemen, there'll be plenty for them to work on. He laughed again. Buckets of dung for all of us to wallow in. And my backers will line up to cancel out. Golden Dawn will never run down her ways. She is not fully covered, as I explained to you. It all hangs on a single thread, Chantel. If the launching of Golden Dawn is delayed now, delayed by a month, no, by a week even, it will all come tumbling down. I'm going to be sick, she whispered thickly. No, you are not. He stood up and crossed quickly to her. Coldly he slapped her face. Two hard, open-handed back-and-forth blows that snapped her head from side to side, leaving the livid marks of his fingers on her pale cheeks. It was the first time ever that a man had struck her, but she could not find the indignation to protest. She merely stared at him. "Pull yourself together," he snarled at her, and gripped her shoulders fiercely, shaking as he went on. Listen to me. I have told you the worst that can happen. Now, I will tell you the best. If we stand together now, if you obey me implicitly without question, I will pull off one of the greatest financial coups of the century for you. All it needs is one successful voyage by Golden Dawn, and we're home free, a single voyage, a few short weeks, and I'll have doubled your fortune. she was staring at him, sickened and shaken to the core of her existence. "I've signed an agreement of charter with Orient Amex that will pull us out from under with a single voyage, and the day Golden Dawn anchors in Galveston Roads and sends in her tank parts to discharge, I will have a dozen buyers for her." He stepped back and straightened the lapels of his jacket. "Men are going to remember my name. In future, when they talk of tankers, they're going to talk of Duncan Alexander." "I hate you," she said softly. "I truly hate you." "That is not important." He waved it away. "When it is over, I can afford to walk away, and you can afford to let me go, but not a moment before." "How much will you make from this, if it succeeds?" she asked, and she was recovering, her voice firmer. "A great deal. A very great deal of money. But my real reward will be in reputation and achievement. After this, I'll be a man who can write his own ticket." "For once, you'll be able to stand comparison with Nicholas Berg. Is that it?" She saw she had scored immediately, and she pressed harder, trying to wound and destroy. "But you and I both know it's not true. Golden Dawn was Nicholas's inspiration, and he would not have had to descend to cheat and sham. My dear Chantel, you will never be, could never be, the man Nicholas is." "Damn you!" Suddenly he was shaking with anger, and she was screaming at him. "You're a cheat and a liar. For all your airs, you're still a cheap little barrow boy at heart. You're small and shoddy. I've beaten Nicholas Berg every time I've met him." "Oh, no, you haven't, Duncan. It was I who beat him for you. I took you. For a while," she sneered. "Just for a short fling, Duncan, dear. But when he wanted me, he took me right back again." "What do you mean by that?" he demanded. "The night before last, Nicholas was here, and he loved me in a way you never could. I'm going back to him, and I'll tell the world why." "You bitch. He is so strong, Duncan. Strong where you are weak. And you are a whore." He half turned away and then paused. "Just be at Saint-Nazaire on Tuesday." But she could see he was hurt. At last, she had cut through the carapace and touched raw, quick nerves. "He loved me 4 times in 1 night, Duncan. Magnificent, soaring love. Did you ever do that?" "I want you at Saint-Nazaire, smiling at the creditors on Tuesday. Even if you succeed with Golden Dawn, within 6 months, Nicholas will have your job. But until then, you'll do exactly what I say." Duncan braced himself, a visible effort, and began to walk away. "You're going to be the loser, Duncan Alexander," she screamed after him, her voice cracking shrilly with frustration and outrage. "I will see to that. I swear it to you." He subdued the urge to run and crossed the terrace, holding himself carefully erect, and the storm of her hatred and frustration burst around him. "Go into the streets where you belong, into the gutter where I found you," she screamed. And he went up the stone staircase and out of her sight. Now he could hurry, but he found his legs were trembling under him. His breath was ragged and broken, and there was a tight knot of anger and jealousy turning his guts into a ball. "The bastard," he spoke aloud. "That bastard Berg." "Tom? Tom Parker?"
"That's right. Who is this, please?"
His voice was so clear and strong, although the Atlantic Ocean separated them. "It's Nicholas. Nicholas Berg."
"Ah, Nick, how are you?" The big voice boomed with genuine pleasure. "God, I'm glad you called. I've been trying to reach you. I've got good news. The best." Nicholas
felt a quick lift of relief. Samantha?
Ah, no, damn it. Tom laughed. It's the job, your job. I went up before the Board of Governors of the university yesterday. I had to sell it to them hard. I'll tell you that for free, but they okayed it. Your aunt, Nick. Isn't that great?
It's terrific, Tom. You're on the biology faculty as an associate. It's the end of the wedge, Nicholas. We'll have you a chair by the end of next year. You wait and see.
I'm delighted. Christ, you don't sound it, Tom roared. What's bugging you, boy?
Tom, what the hell has happened to Samantha?
And Nicholas sensed the mood change. The silence lasted a beat too long, and then Tom's tone was guileless.
She went off on a field trip, down the Keys, didn't she tell you?
Down the Keys? Nicholas's voice rose with his anger and frustration.
Damn it, Tom, she was supposed to be here in France. She promised to come over for the launching of my new vessel. I've been trying to get in touch with her for a week now.
She left Sunday, said Tom.
What is she playing at?
That's a question she might want to ask you sometime.
What does that mean, Tom?
Well, before she took off, she came up here and had a good weep with Antoinette, you know, my wife. She plays den mother for every hysterical female within 50 miles, she does.
Now it was Nicholas's turn to be silent, while the coldness settled on his chest, the coldness of formless dread.
What was the trouble?
Oh, good God, Nick. You don't expect me to follow the intimate details of the love life.
Can I speak to Antoinette?
She isn't here, Nick. She went up to Orlando for a meeting. She won't be back until the weekend.
The silence again.
All that heavy breathing is costing you a fortune, Nicholas. You're paying for this call.
I don't know what got into Sam. But he did. Nicholas knew, and the guilt was strong upon him.
Listen, Nick, a word to the wise. Get your ass across here, boy, just as soon as you can. The girl needs talking to badly, that is, if you care about it.
I care about it, Nicholas said quickly. But hell, I'm launching a tug in 2 days' time. I've got sea trials and a meeting in London.
Thomas' voice had an air of finality. A man's got to do what he's got to do.
Tom, I'll be across there as soon as I possibly can.
I believe it.
If you see her, tell her that for me, will you?
I'll tell her.
Thanks, Tom.
The governors will want to meet you, Nicholas. Come as soon as you can.
It's a promise.
Nicholas cradled the receiver and stood staring out of the windows of the site office. The view across the inner harbor was completely blocked by the towering hull of his tug. She stood tall on her ways. Her hull already wore its final coat of glistening white, and the wide flaring bows bore the name Sea Witch, and below that, the port of registration, Bermuda. She was beautiful, magnificent. But now Nicholas did not even see her. He was overwhelmed by a sense of imminent loss, the cold premonition of onrushing disaster. Until that moment, when he faced the prospect of losing her, he had not truly known how large a part that lovely golden girl had come to play in his existence and in his plans for the future. There was no way that Samantha could have learned of that single night of weakness, the betrayal that still left Nicholas sickened with guilt. There must be something else that had come between them. He bunched his right fist and slammed it against the sill of the window. The skin of his knuckles smeared, but he did not feel the pain, only the bitter frustration of being tied down here in Saint-Nazaire, weighed down by his responsibilities, when he should have been free to follow the jack-o'-lantern of happiness. The loudspeaker above his head gave a preliminary squawk and then crackled out the message, Monsieur Berg, will Monsieur attend upon the bridge? It was a welcome distraction, and Nicholas hurried out into the spring sunshine. Looking upwards, he could see Jules Le Voisin on the wing of the bridge. His portly figure foreshortened against the open sky, like a small, pugnacious rooster. He stood facing the electronics engineer, who was responsible for the installation of Sea Witch's communication system. And Jules' cries of "Sacré bleu!" and "Merde!" and "Imbécile!" carried clearly above the cacophony of shipyard noises. Nicholas started to run as he saw the engineer's arms begin to wave and his strident Gallic cries blended with those of Sea Witch's new master. It was only the third time that Jules Le Voisin had become hysterical that day. However, it was not yet noon. As the hour of launching came steadily closer, so the little Frenchman's nerves played him tricks. He was behaving like a prima ballerina awaiting the opening curtain. Unless Nicholas reached the bridge within the next few minutes, he would need either a new master or a new electronics engineer. 10 minutes later, Nicholas had a cheroot in each of their mouths. The atmosphere was still tense, but no longer explosive, and gently Nick took the engineer by the elbow, placed his other arm around Jules Le Voisin's shoulders, and led them both back into the wheelhouse. The bridge installation was complete, and Jules Le Voisin was accepting delivery of the special equipment from the contractors. A negotiation every bit as traumatic as the Treaty of Versailles. I myself authorized the modification of the Mark IV transponder, Nicholas explained patiently. We had trouble with the same unit on Warlock. I should have told you, Jules.
You should have, agreed the little master huffily.
But you were perceptive to notice the change from the specification, Nicholas soothed him.
And Jules puffed out his chest a little and rolled the cheroot in his mouth. I may be an old dog, but I know all the new tricks. He removed the cheroot and smugly blew a perfect smoke ring.
When Nicholas at last left them chatting amiably over the massed array of sophisticated equipment that lined the navigation area at the back of the bridge, they were paging him from the site office.
What is it? He asked, as he came in through the door.
It's a lady. The foreman indicated the telephone lying on the littered desk below the window.
Samantha, Nick thought, and snatched up the receiver.
Nicky. He felt the shock of quick guilt at the voice.
Chantel, where are you?
In La Baule. The fashionable resort town just up the Atlantic coast was a better setting for Chantel Alexander than the grubby port with its sprawling dockyard. Staying at the Castile. God, it's too awful. I've forgotten how awful it was. They had stayed there together once long ago, in a different life it seemed now. But the restaurant is still quite cute, Nicholas. Have lunch with me. I must speak to you.
I can't leave here. He would not walk into the trap again.
It's important. I must see you.
She could hear that husky tone in her voice. Imagine clearly the sensuous droop of the eyelids over those bold Persian eyes.
For an hour, only an hour. You can spare that.
Despite himself, he felt the pull of temptation, the dull ache of it at the base of his belly. And he was angry at her for the power she could still exert over him.
If it's important, then come here, he said brusquely, and she sighed at his intransigence.
All right, Nicholas. How will I find you?
The Rolls was parked opposite the dockside gates, and Nicholas crossed the road and stepped through the door that the chauffeur held open for him.
Chantel
lifted her face to him. Her hair was cloudy dark and shot with light like a bolt of silk. Her lips the color of ripe fruit, moist and slightly parted. He ignored the invitation and touched her cheek with his lips before settling into the corner opposite her. She made a little moo and slanted her eyes at him in amusement. How chaste we are, Nicky. Nicholas touched the button on the control console, and the glass, soundproof partition slid up noiselessly between them and the chauffeur. Did you send in the auditors? He asked. You look tired, darling, and harassed. Have you blown the whistle on Duncan? He avoided the distraction. The work on Golden Dawn is still going ahead. The arc lights were burning over all night, and the talk in the yards is that she's being launched at noon tomorrow, almost a month ahead of schedule. What happened, Chantel? There's a little bistro in Mandin. It's just across the bridge. Damn it, Chantel. I haven't time to fool around. But the Rolls was already gliding swiftly through the narrow streets of the port, between the high warehouse buildings. It'll take 5 minutes, and the lobster, Americaine, is the local speciality. Not to be confused with lobster Americaine. They do it in a cream sauce. It's superb. She chatted archly, and the Rolls turned out onto the quay. Across the narrow waters of the inner harbour humped the ugly camouflage mounds of the Nazi submarine pens, armoured concrete so thick as to resist the bombs of the RAF, and the efforts of all demolition experts over the years since then. Peter asked me to give you his love. He's got his junior team colours. I'm so proud. Nicholas thrust his hands deep into his jacket pockets and slumped down resignedly against the soft leather seat. I'm delighted to hear it, he said. And they were silent then, until the chauffeur checked the rolls at the toll barrier to pay before accelerating out onto the ramp of the Saint-Nazaire Bridge. The great span of the bridge rose in a regal curve, 300 feet above the waters of the Loire River. The river was almost 3 miles wide here, and from the highest point of the bridge there was an aerial view over the dockyards of the town. There were half a dozen vessels building along the banks of the broad, muddy river, a mighty forest of steel scaffolding, tall gantries and half-assembled hulls, but all of it insignificant under the mountainous bulk of Golden Dawn. Without her pod tanks, she had an incomplete, gutted appearance, as though the Eiffel Tower had toppled over and somebody had built a modernistic apartment block at one end. It seemed impossible that such a structure was capable of floating. God, she was ugly, Nick thought. They're still working on her, he said. One of the gantries was moving ponderously along the length of the ship, like an arthritic dinosaur. And at 50 places, the brilliant blue electric fires of the welding torches flickered, while upon the grotesquely riven hull crawled human figures reduced to ant-like insignificance by the sheer size of the vessel. They're still working. He repeated it as an accusation. Nicholas, nothing in this life is simple. Did you spell it out for Duncan? Except for people like you. You didn't confront Duncan, did you? He accused bitterly. It's easy for you to be strong. It's one of the things that first attracted me. And Nicholas almost laughed aloud. It was ludicrous to talk of strength after his many displays of weakness with this very woman. Did you call Duncan's cards? He insisted. And she put him off with a smile. Let's wait until we have a glass of wine. Now, he snapped. Tell me right now, Chantel. I haven't time for games. Yes, I spoke to him. She nodded. I called him down to Cap Ferra, and I accused him of what you suspected. He denied it? If he denies it, I now have further proof. No, Nicholas. He didn't deny a thing. He told me that I knew only the half of it. Her voice rose sharply, and suddenly it all spilled out in a torrent of tortured words. Her composure was eroded swiftly away as she relived the enormity of her predicament. "He's gambled with my fortune, Nicholas. He's risked the family share of Christie Marine, the trust shares, my shares. It's all at risk. And he gloated as he told me. He truly gloried in his betrayal." "We've got him now." Nicholas had straightened slowly in his seat as he listened. His voice was grimly satisfied, and he nodded. "That's it. We will stop the Golden Dawn like that." He hammered his bunched fist into the palm of the other hand with a sharp crack. "We will get an urgent order before the courts." Nicholas stopped suddenly and stared at her. Chantelle was shaking her head slowly from side to side. Her eyes slowly filled, making them huge and glistening. A single tear spilled over the lid and clung in the thick dark lashes like a drop of morning dew. The rolls had stopped now outside the tiny bistro. It was on the riverfront, with a view across the water to the dockyards. To the west, the river debouched into the open sea, and in the east, the beautiful arch of the bridge rose against the pale blue spring sky. The chauffeur held open the door, and Chantelle was gone with her swift, bird-like grace, leaving Nicholas no choice but to follow her. The proprietor came through from his kitchen and fussed over Chantelle, seating her at the window and lingering to discuss the menu. Let's drink the Muscadet, Nicholas. She'd always had the most amazing powers of recovery. And now the tears were gone, and she was brittle and gay and beautiful, smiling at him over the rim of her glass. The sunlight, through the leaded window panes, danced in the cool golden wine and rippled on the smoky dark fall of her hair. "Here's to us, Nicholas, darling. We are the last of the great." It was a toast from long ago, from the other life, and it irritated him now, but he drank it silently and then set down the glass. "Chantelle, when and how are you going to stop Duncan?" "Don't spoil the meal, darling." "In about 30 seconds, I'm going to start becoming very angry." She studied him for a moment and saw that it was true. "All right, then," she agreed reluctantly. "When are you going to stop him?" "I'm not, darling." He stared at her. "What did you say?" he asked quietly. "I'm going to do everything in my power to help him launch and sail the Golden Dawn." "You don't understand, Chantelle. You're talking about risking 1 million tons of the most deadly poison." "Oh, don't be silly, Nicky. Keep that heroic talk for the newspapers. I don't care if Duncan dumps 1 million tons of cadmium in the water supply of Greater London, just as long as he pulls the trust and me out of the fire. There's still time to make the modifications to Golden Dawn." "No, there isn't. You don't understand, darling. Duncan has put us so deeply into it that a delay of a few days even would bring us down. He has stripped the cupboard bare, Nicky. There is no money for modifications, no time for anything, except to get Golden Dawn underway. There's always a way and a means." "Yes, and the way is to fill Golden Dawn's pods tanks with crude." "He's frightened you by..." "Yes," she agreed. "I'm frightened. I've never been so frightened in my life, Nicky. I could lose everything. I'm terrified. I could lose it all." She shivered with the horror of it. "I would kill myself if that happened." "I'm still going to stop Duncan." "No, Nicky. Please just leave it. For my sake. For Peter's sake. It's Peter's inheritance that we're talking about. Let Golden Dawn make one voyage. Just one voyage, and I'll be safe." "It's the risk to an ocean. God alone knows how many human lives we're talking about." "Don't shout, Nicky. People are looking. Let them look.
I'm going to stop that monster.
No, Nicholas. Without me, you cannot do a thing. You best believe it.
Darling, I promise you, after her first voyage, we will sell Golden Dawn. We'll be safe then, and I can rid myself of Duncan. It'll be you and I again, Nicky. A few short weeks, that's all.
It took all his self-control to prevent his anger showing. He clenched his fists on the starched white tablecloth, but his voice was cool and even.
Just one more question, Chantel. When did you telephone Samantha Silver?
She looked puzzled for a moment, as though she was trying to put a face to a name.
Samantha? Oh, your little friend. Why should I want to telephone her?
And then her expression changed.
Oh, Nicky, you don't really believe I'd do that. You don't really believe I would tell anybody about it, about that wonderful...
Now she was stricken. Again those huge eyes brimmed, and she reached across and stroked the fine black hairs on the back of Nicholas's big square hand.
You don't think that of me. I'm not that much of a bitch. I don't have to cheat to get the things I want. I don't have to inflict unnecessary hurt on people.
No, Nicholas agreed quietly. You'd not murder more than a million, or poison more than a single ocean at a time, would you?
He pushed back his chair.
Sit down, Nicky. Eat your lobster.
Suddenly, I'm not hungry.
He stripped 2 100-franc notes from his money clip and dropped them beside his plate.
I forbid you to leave, she hissed angrily.
You're humiliating me, Nicholas.
I'll send your car back, he said, and walked out into the sunlight.
He found with surprise that he was trembling, and that his jaws were clenched so tightly that his teeth ached.
The wind turned during the night, and the morning was cold with drifts of low, grey, fast-flying cloud that threatened rain. Nicholas pulled up his collar against the wind, and the tails of his coat flogged about his legs, for he was exposed on the highest point of the arched bridge of Saint-Nazaire. Thousands of others had braved the wind, and the guardrail was lined 2 and 3 deep, all the way across the curve of the northern span. The traffic had backed up, and half a dozen gendarmes were trying to get it moving again. Their whistles shrilled plaintively. Faintly, the sound of a band floated up to them, rising and falling in volume as the wind caught it. And even with the naked eye, Nicholas could make out the wreaths of gaily coloured bunting which fluttered on the high, cumbersome stern tower of Golden Dawn. He glanced at his wristwatch and saw it was a few minutes before noon. A helicopter clattered noisily under the grey belly of cloud and hovered above the yards of Construction Navale Atlantique on the gleaming silver coin of its rotor. Nicholas lifted the binoculars, and the eyepieces were painfully cold against his skin. Through the lens, he could almost make out individual features among the small gathering on the rostrum under the tanker's stern. The platform was decorated with a tricolour and a Union Jack. And as he watched, the band fell silent and lowered their instruments.
Speech time, Nicholas murmured.
And now he could make out Duncan Alexander, his bared head catching one of the fleeting rays of sun, a glimmer of coppery gold as he looked up at the towering stern of Golden Dawn. His bulk was almost obscured, the tiny feminine figure beside him. Chantel wore that particular shade of malachite green which she so dearly loved. There was confused activity around Chantel, half a dozen gentlemen assisting in the ceremony she'd performed so very often. Chantel had broken the champagne on almost all of Christie Marine's fleet. The first time had been when she was Arthur Christie's 14-year-old darling. It was another of the company's many traditions. Nicholas blinked, believing for an instant that his eyes had tricked him, for it seemed that the very earth had changed its shape and was moving. Then he saw that the great hull of Golden Dawn had begun to slide forward. The band burst into the Marseillaise, the heroic strains watered down by wind and distance, while Golden Dawn gathered momentum. It was an incredible, even a stirring sight, and despite himself, Nicholas felt the goosebumps rise upon his forearms and the hair lift on the back of his neck. He was a sailor, and he was watching the berthing of the mightiest vessel ever built. She was grotesque, monstrous, but she was part of him. No matter that others had bastardized and perverted his grand design, still the original design was his, and he found himself gripping the binoculars with hands that shook. He watched the massive wooden-wedged arrestors kick out from under that great gliding mass of steel as they served to control her stern-first rush down the ways. The steel cable whipped and snaked upon itself like the Medusa's hair, and Golden Dawn's stern struck the water. The brown, muddy water of the estuary opened before her, cleaved by the irresistible rush and weight, and the hull drove deep, opening white-capped rollers that spread out across the channel and broke upon the shores with a dull roar that carried clearly to where Nicholas stood. The crowd that lined the bridge was cheering wildly. Beside him, a mother held her infant up to watch, both of them screaming with glee. While Golden Dawn's bows were still on the dockyard's ways, her stern was thrusting irresistibly a mile out into the river. Forced down by the raised bows, it must now be almost touching the muddy bottom, for the wave was breaking around her stern quarters. God, she was huge. Nicholas shook his head in wonder. If only he had been able to build her the right way, what a ship she would have been. What a magnificent concept. Now her bows left the end of the slips, and the waters burst about her, seething and leaping into swirling vortices. Her stern started to rise, gathering speed as her own buoyancy caught her, and she burst out like a great whale rising to blow. The waters spilled from her, creaming and cascading through the steelwork of her open decks, boiling madly in the cavernous openings that would hold the pod tanks when she was fully loaded. Now she came up short on the hundreds of retaining cables that prevented her from driving clear across the river and throwing herself ashore on the far bank. She fought against this restraint, as though having felt the water, she was now eager to run. She rolled and dipped and swung with a ponderous majesty that kept the crowds along the bridge cheering wildly. Then, slowly, she settled and floated quietly, seeming to fill the Loire River from bank to bank and to reach as high as the soaring spans of the bridge itself. The four attendant harbour tugs moved in quickly to assist the ship to turn its prodigious length and to line up for the roads and the open sea. They butted and backed, working as a highly skilled team, and slowly they coaxed Golden Dawn around. Her sideways motion left a mile-wide sweep of disturbed water across the estuary. Then, suddenly, there was a tremendous boil under her counter, and Nicholas saw the bronze flash of her single screw sweeping slowly through the brown water. Faster and still faster it turned, and despite himself, Nicholas thrilled to see her come alive. A ripple formed under her bows, and almost imperceptibly she began to creep forward, overcoming the vast inertia of her weight, gathering steerage way, under command at last. The harbour tugs fell back respectfully, and as the mighty bows lined up with the open sea, she drove forward determinedly. The silver spouts of steam from the sirens of the tugs shot high, and moments later the booming bellow of their salute crashed against the skies. The crowds had dispersed, and Nicholas stood alone in the wind on the high bridge and watched the structured steel towers of Golden Dawn's hull blending with the grey and misted horizon. He watched her turn, coming around on her great circle course that would carry her 6,000 miles southward to Good Hope. And, even at this distance, he sensed her change in mood as she steadied and her single screw began to push her to top economic speed. Nicholas checked his watch and murmured the age-old master's command that commenced every voyage. "Full away at 17 hours," he said, and turned to trudge back along the bridge to where he'd left the hired Renault. It was after 6 o'clock, and the site office was empty by the time Nicholas got back to Seawitch. He threw himself into a chair and lit a cheroot, while he thumbed quickly through his address book. He found what he wanted, dialed the direct London code, and then the number. "Good afternoon. This is the Sunday Times. May I help you?" "Is Mr. Herbstein available?" Nicholas asked. "Hold on, please." While he waited, Nicholas checked his address book for his next most likely contact. Should the journalist be climbing the Himalayas or visiting a guerrilla training camp in Central Africa, either of which were highly likely? Within seconds, he heard his voice. "Dennis," he said, "this is Nicholas Berg. How are you? I've got a hell of a story for you." Nicholas tried to bear the indignity of it with stoicism, but the thick coating of pancake makeup seemed to clog the pores of his skin, and he moved restlessly in the makeup chair. "Please keep still, sir," the makeup girl snapped irritably. There was a line of unfortunates awaiting her ministrations along the bench at the back of the narrow room. One of them was Duncan Alexander, and he caught Nicholas's eye in the mirror and raised an eyebrow in a mocking salute. In the chair beside him, the anchor man of the Today and Tomorrow show lolled graciously. He was tall and elegant, with dyed and permanently waved hair, a carnation in his buttonhole, a high camp manner, and an ostentatiously liberal image. "I've given you the first slot. If it gets interesting, I'll run you 4 minutes 40 seconds. Otherwise, I'll cut it off at 2. Dennis Herbstein's Sunday article had been done with high professionalism, especially bearing in mind the very short time he'd had to put it together. It had included interviews with representatives of Lloyd's of London, the oil companies, environmental experts, both in America and England, and even with the United States Coast Guard. "Try to make it tight and hard," advised the anchorman. "Let's not pussyfoot around." He wanted sensation, not too many facts or figures, good gory horror stuff, or a satisfying punch-up. The Sunday Times article had flushed them out at Orient Amex and Christy Marine. They had not been able to ignore the challenge, for there was a question table for Thursday by a Labour member in the Commons, and ominous stirrings in the ranks of the American Coast Guard Service. There had been enough fuss to excite the interest of the Today and Tomorrow show. They had invited the parties to meet their accuser, and both Christy Marine and Orient Amex had fielded their first teams. Duncan Alexander, with all his charisma, had come to speak for Christy Marine, and Orient Amex had selected one of their directors who looked like Gary Cooper. With his craggy, honest face and silver hairs at his temple, he looked like the kind of man you wanted flying your airliner or looking after your money. The makeup girl dusted Nicholas's face with powder. "I'm going to invite you to speak first. Tell us all about this stuff. What is it? Cadmium." The interviewer checked his script. Nicholas nodded. He could not speak, for he was suffering the ultimate indignity. The girl was painting his lips. The television studio was the size of an aircraft hangar, the concrete floor strewn with thick black cables, and the roof lost in the gloomy heights. But they had created the illusion of intimacy in the small shell of the stage, around which the big mobile cameras cluttered like mechanical crabs around the carcass of a dead fish. The egg-shaped chairs made it impossible either to loll or to sit upright, and the merciless white glare of the arc lamps fried the thick layer of greasy makeup on Nicholas's skin. It was a small consolation that across the table, Duncan looked like a Japanese kabuki dancer in makeup too white for his coppery hair. An assistant director in a sweatshirt and jeans clipped the small microphone into Nicholas's lapel and whispered, "Give them hell, ducky." Somebody else in the darkness beyond the lights was intoning solemnly, 4, 3, 2, 1, you're on. And the red light lit on the middle camera. Welcome to the Today and Tomorrow Show. The anchorman's voice was suddenly warm and intimate and mellifluous. Last week, in the French shipbuilding port of Saint-Nazaire, the largest ship in the world was launched. In a dozen sentences, he sketched out the facts, while on the repeating screens beyond the cameras, Nicholas saw they were running newsreel footage of Golden Dawn's launching. He remembered the helicopter hovering over the dockyard, and he was so fascinated by the aerial views of the enormous vessel taking to the water that when the cameras switched suddenly to him, he was taken by surprise and saw himself start on the little screen as the interviewer began introducing him, swiftly running a thumbnail portrait and then going on, "Mr. Berg has some very definite views on this ship." In her present design and construction, she is not safe to carry even regular crude petroleum oil, Nicholas said. However, she will be employed in the carriage of crude oil that has been contaminated by cadmium sulfide in such concentrations as to make it one of the most toxic substances in nature. Your first statement, Mr. Berg, does anyone else share your doubts as to the safety of her design? She does not carry the A1 rating by the Marine Inspectors of Lloyd's of London, said Nicholas. Now, can you tell us about the cargo she will carry, the so-called cad-rich crudes? Nicholas knew he had perhaps 15 seconds to draw a verbal picture of the Atlantic Ocean turned into a sterile, poison desert. It was too short a time, and twice Duncan Alexander interjected, skillfully breaking up the logic of Nicholas's presentation. Before he'd finished, the anchor man glanced at his watch and cut him short. Thank you, Mr. Berg. Now, Mr. Kemp is a director of the oil company. My company, Orient Amex, last year allocated the sum of $2 million as grants to assist in the scientific study of world environmental problems. I can tell you folks right now that we at Orient Amex are very conscious of the problems of modern technology. He was projecting the oil company image, the benefactors of all humanity. Your company's profit last year after taxation was $425 million, Nicholas cut in clearly. That makes 0.47% on environmental research, all of it tax-deductible. Congratulations, Mr. Kemp. The oil man looked pained and went on. Now, we at Orient Amex, plugging the company name again neatly, are working towards a better quality of life for all peoples. But we do realize that it's impossible to put back the clock 100 years. We cannot allow ourselves to be blinded by the romantic, wishful thinking of amateur environmentalists, the weekend scientists, and the doom criers who cry Torrey Canyon, Nicholas suggested helpfully, and the oil man suppressed a shudder and went on quickly, who would have us discontinue such research as the revolutionary cadmium cracking process, which could extend the world's utilization of fossil fuels by a staggering 40% and give the world's oil reserves an extended life of 20 years or more. Again, the anchor man glanced at his watch, cut the oil man off in mid-flow, and switched his attention to Duncan Alexander. Mr. Alexander, your so-called ultra-tanker will carry the Cadridge crudes. How would you reply to Mr. Berg? Duncan smiled, a deep, secret smile. When Mr. Berg had my job as head of Christie Marine, The Golden Dawn was the best idea in the world. Since he was fired, it's suddenly the worst. They laughed. Even one of the cameramen, out beyond the lights, guffawed uncontrollably. And Nicholas felt the hot red flush of his anger. "Is the Golden Dawn rated A1 at Lloyd's?" asked the anchorman. "Christy Marine has not applied for a Lloyd's listing. We arrange our insurance in other markets." Even through his anger, Nicholas had to concede how good he was. He had a mind like quicksilver. "How safe is your ship, Mr. Alexander?" Now Duncan turned his head and looked directly across the table at Nicholas. "I believe she's as safe as the world's leading marine architects and naval engineers can make her." He paused, and there was a malevolent gleam in his eyes now. "So safe that I've decided to end this ridiculous controversy by a display of my personal confidence." "What form will this show of faith take, Mr. Alexander?" The anchorman sensed the sensational line for which he'd been groping, and he leaned forward eagerly. "On Golden Dawn's maiden voyage, when she returns from the Persian Gulf fully laden with the El Barras crudes, I and my family, my wife and my stepson, will travel aboard her for the final 6,000 miles of her voyage, from Cape Town on the Cape of Good Hope to Galveston in the Gulf of Mexico." As Nicholas gaped at him wordlessly, he went on evenly, "That's how convinced I am that Golden Dawn is capable of performing her task in perfect safety." "Thank you." The anchor man recognized a good exit line when he heard one. "Thank you, Mr. Alexander. You've convinced me, and I'm sure you've convinced many of our viewers. We're now crossing to Washington via satellite where..." The moment the red in-use light flickered out on the television camera, Nicholas was on his feet and facing Duncan Alexander. His anger was fanned by the realization that Duncan had easily grandstanded him with that adroit display of showmanship, and by the stabbing anxiety at the threat to take Peter aboard Golden Dawn on her hazardous maiden voyage. "You're not taking Peter on that death trap of yours," he snapped. "That's his mother's decision," said Duncan evenly. "As the daughter of Arthur Christie, she's decided to give the company her full support." He emphasized the word full. "I won't let either of you endanger my son's life for a wild public relations stunt." "I'm sure you will try to prevent it," Duncan nodded and smiled. "And I'm sure your efforts will be as ineffectual as your attempts to stop Golden Dawn." He deliberately turned his back on Nicholas and spoke to the oil man. "I do think that went off rather well," he said. "Don't you?" James Teacher gave a graphic demonstration of why he could charge the highest fees in London and still have his desk piled high with important briefs. He had Nicholas's urgent application before a judge in chambers within 72 hours, petitioning for a writ to restrain Chantel Alexander from allowing the son of their former marriage, one Peter Nicholas Berg, aged 12 years, to accompany her on an intended voyage from Cape Town, in the Republic of South Africa, to Galveston, in the state of Texas, aboard the bulk crude carrier Golden Dawn, and or to prevent the said Chantel Alexander from allowing the child to undertake any other voyage aboard said vessel. The judge heard the petition during a recess in the criminal trial of a young post office worker standing accused of multiple rape. The judge's oak-paneled, book-lined chambers were overcrowded by the two parties, their lawyers, the judge's registrar, and the considerable bulk of the judge himself. Still in his wig and robes from the public court, the judge read swiftly through the written submission of both sides, listened attentively to James Teacher's short address, and the rebuttal by his opposite number, before turning sternly to Chantel. "Mrs. Alexander." The stern expression wavered slightly as he looked upon the devastating beauty which sat demurely before him. Do you love your son? More than anything else in this life. Chantel looked at him steadily out of those vast dark eyes. And you are happy to take him on this journey with you? I am the daughter of a sailor. If there was danger, I would understand it. I am happy to go myself and take my son with me. The judge nodded, looked down at the papers on his desk for a moment. As I understand the circumstances, Mr. Teacher, it is common ground that the mother has custody. That is so, my lord. But the father is the child's guardian. I am fully aware of that, thank you, he snapped acidly. He paused again before resuming in the measured tones of judgment. We are concerned here exclusively with the welfare and safety of the child. It has been shown that the proposed journey will be made during the holidays and that no loss of schooling will result. On the other hand, I do not believe that the petitioner has shown that there exists reasonable doubts about the safety of the vessel on which the voyage will be made. It seems to be a modern and sophisticated ship. To grant the petition would, in my view, be placing unreasonable restraint on the child's mother. He swiveled in his chair to face Nicholas and James' teacher. I regret, therefore, that I see insufficient grounds to accede to your petition. In the back seat of James' teacher's Bentley, the little lawyer murmured apologetically. He was right, of course, Nicholas. I would have done the same in his place. These domestic squabbles are always... Nicholas was not listening. What would happen if I picked up Peter and took him to Bermuda or the States? Abduct him? James' teacher's voice shot up an octave, and he caught Nicholas's arm with genuine alarm. I beg of you, dismiss the thought. They would have the police waiting for you. God! Now he wriggled miserably in his seat. I can't bear to think of what might happen. Apart from getting you sent to jail, your former wife might even get an order restraining you from seeing your boy again. She could get guardianship away from you. If you did that, you could lose the child, Nicholas. Don't do it. Please, don't do it. Now he patted Nicholas's arm ingratiatingly. You'd be playing right into their hands. And then, with relief, he switched his attention to the briefcase on his lap. Can we read through the last draft of the agreement of sale again? He asked. We haven't got much time, you know. Then, without waiting for a reply, he began on the preamble to the agreement, which would transfer all the assets and liabilities of Ocean Salvage and Towage to the directors of the Bank of the East as nominees for parties unnamed. Nicholas slumped in the far corner of the seat and stared thoughtfully out of the window as the Bentley crawled in the traffic stream out of the Strand, around Trafalgar Square, with its wheeling clouds of pigeons and milling throngs of tourists, swung into the Mall and accelerated down the long straight towards the palace. I want you to stall them, Nicholas said suddenly, and teacher broke off in the middle of a sentence and stared at him distractedly. I beg your pardon. I want you to find a way to stall the sheikhs. Good God, man. James' teacher was utterly astounded. It's taken me nearly a month. 4 hard weeks to get them ripe to sign. His voice choked a little at the memory of the long hours of negotiation. I've written every line of the agreement in my own blood. I need to have control of my tongues. I need to be free to act. Nicholas, we're talking about $7 million. We're talking about my son, said Nicholas quietly. Can you stall them? Yes, of course I can, if that's what you truly want. Wearily, James' teacher closed the file on his lap. How long? 6 weeks. Long enough for Golden Dawn to finish her maiden voyage one way or the other. You realize that this may blow the whole deal, don't you? Yes, I realize that. And you realize also that there isn't another buyer. Yes. They were silent again. until the Bentley pulled up before the bank building in Curzon Street, and then stepped out onto the pavement. "Are you absolutely certain?" Teacher asked softly. "Just do it," Nicholas replied, and the doorman held the bronze and glass doors open for them. Bermuda asserted its calming influence over Nicholas the moment he stepped out of the aircraft into its comfortable warmth and clean, glittering sunlight. Bernard Wacky's gorgeous, burnt, honey-coloured secretary was there to welcome him. She wore a thin cotton dress, the colour of freshly cut pineapple, and a flashing white smile. "Mr. Wacky's waiting for you at the bank, sir." "Are you out of your mind, Nicholas?" Bernard greeted him. "Jimmy Teacher tells me you blew the Arabs out of the window. Tell me it's not true. Please, tell me it's not true." "Oh, come on, Bernard." Nicholas shook his head and patted him consolingly on the shoulder. "Your commission would only have been a lousy 0.7 million anyway." "Then you did it," Bernard wailed, and tried to pull his hand out of Nicholas's grip. "You screwed it all up." "The sheikhs have been screwing us up for over a month, Bernie baby. I just gave them a belt of the same medicine. And you know what? They loved it. The prince sat up and showed real interest for the first time. For the first time, we were speaking the same language. They'll still be around 6 weeks from now." "But why? I don't understand. Just explain to me why you did it." "Let's go into the plot, and I'll explain it to you." In the plot, Nicholas stood over the Perspex map of the oceans of the globe and studied it carefully for fully 5 minutes without speaking. "That Sea Witch's latest position. She's making good passage?" The green plastic disc that bore the tug's number was set in mid-Atlantic. "She reported 2 hours ago." Bernie nodded, and then with professional interest, "How did her sea trials go off?" "There were the usual wrinkles to iron out, but that's what kept me in Saint-Nazaire so long. But we got them straight, and Jules has fallen in love with her. He's still the best skipper in the game." But already Nicholas's attention had switched halfway across the world. "Warlock's still in Mauritius." His voice snapped like a whip. "I had to fly out a new armature for the main generator. It was just bad luck that she broke down in that godforsaken part of the world." "When will she be ready for sea?" "Alan promises noon tomorrow. Do you want to telex him for an update on that?" "Later." Nicholas wet the tip of a cheroot carefully, without taking his eyes off the plot, calculating distances and currents and speeds. "Golden Dawn?" he asked, and lit the cheroot while he listened to Berner's reply. "Her pod tanks arrived under tow at the new Orient Amex depot on El Barras 3 weeks ago." Bernie picked up the pointer and touched the upper bight of the deep Persian Gulf. "They took on their full cargoes of crude and lay inshore to await Golden Dawn's arrival." For a moment, Nicholas contemplated the task of towing those 4 gigantic pod tanks from Japan to the Gulf. And then he discarded the thought and listened to Bernard. "Golden Dawn arrived last Thursday, and according to my agent at El Barras, she coupled up with her pod tanks and made her turn around within 3 hours. Bernard slid the tip of the pointer southwards down the eastern coast of the African continent. "I've had no report on her since then, but if she makes good her 22 knots, then she'll be somewhere off the coast of Mozambique, or Maputo, as they call it now, and she should double the Cape within the next few days. I'll have a report on her then. She'll be taking on mail as she passes Cape Town." "And passengers," said Nicholas grimly. He knew that Peter and Chantel were in Cape Town already. He had telephoned the boy the night before, and Peter had been wildly elated at the prospect of the voyage on the Ultra Tanker. It's going to be tremendous fun, Dad. His voice cracking with the onset of both excitement and puberty. We'll be flying out to the ship in a helicopter. Bernard Wacky changed the subject, now picking up a sheaf of telex flimsies and thumbing swiftly through them. Right. I've confirmed the standby contract for Sea Witch. Nicholas nodded. The contract was for Jules Levoisin and the new tug to stand by three offshore working rigs, standard exploration rigs, that were drilling in the Florida Bay, that elbow of shallow water formed by the sweep of the Florida Keys and the low, swampy morass of the Everglades. It's ridiculous to use a 22,000-horsepower ocean-going tug as an oil rig standby. Bernard lowered the file and could no longer contain his irritation. Jules is going to go bananas, sitting around playing nursemaid. You're going to have a mutiny on your hands, and you'll be losing money. The daily hire won't cover your direct costs. She will be sitting exactly where I want her, said Nicholas, and switched his attention back to the tiny dot of an island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Now, Warlock. Right, Warlock. Bernie picked up another file. I have tendered for a deep-sea tow. Cancel it, said Nicholas. Just as soon as Alan has repaired his generator, I want him running top of the green for Cape Town. For Cape Town? Top of the green? Bernard stared at him. Christ, Nicholas. What for? He won't be able to catch Golden Dawn before she rounds the Cape, but I want him to follow her. Oh, Nicholas, you're out of your mind. Do you know what that would cost? If Golden Dawn gets into trouble, he'll be only a day or two behind her. Tell Annan he's to shadow her all the way into Galveston Roads. Nicholas, you're letting this whole thing get out of all proportion. It's become an obsession with you, for God's sake. With her superior speed, Warlock should be up with her before she enters the... Listen to me, Nicholas. Let's think this all out carefully. What are the chances of Golden Dawn suffering structural failure or crippling breakdown on her maiden voyage? 100-1 against it? It's that high. That's about right, Nicholas agreed. 100-1. What is it going to cost to hold one ocean-going salvage tug on standby at a lousy $1,500 a day, and then to send another halfway around the world on top of the green? Bernard clasped his brow theatrically. It's going to cost you $250,000 if you take into consideration the loss of earnings on both vessels. That's the very least it's going to cost you. Don't you have respect for money any longer? Now you understand why I had to stall the sheikhs, Nicholas smiled calmly. I couldn't shoot their money on 100-1 chance. But it's not their money yet. It's mine. Sea Witch and Warlock aren't their tugs. They are mine. Peter isn't their son. He's mine. You're serious, said Bernard incredulously. I do believe you are serious. Right, Nicholas agreed. Damned right I am. Now get a telex off to David Allen and ask him for his estimated time of arrival in Cape Town. Samantha Silver had one towel wrapped around her head like a turban. Her hair was still wet from the luxurious shampooing it had just received. She wore the other towel tucked under her armpits, making a short sarong of it. She still glowed all over from the steaming tub, and she smelled of soap and talcum powder. After a long field trip, it took two or three of these soakings and scrubbings to get the salt and the smell of the mangroves out of her pores, and the Everglades mud from under her nails. She poured the batter into the pan, the oil spitting and crackling with the heat, and she sang out, "How many waffles can you eat?" He came through from the bathroom, a wet towel wrapped around his waist, and he stood in the doorway and grinned at her. "How many have you got?" he asked. She had still not accustomed her ear to the Australian twang. He was burned and brown as she was, and his hair was bleached at the ends, hanging now, wet from the shower, into his face. They had worked well together, and she had learned much from him. The drift into intimacy had been gradual but inevitable. In her hurt, she had turned to him for comfort, and also in deliberate spite of Nicholas. But now, if she turned her head away, she would not really be able to remember his features clearly. It took an effort to remember his name. Dennis, of course. Dr. Dennis O'Connor. She was detached from it all, as though a sheet of armored glass separated her from the real world. She went through the motions of working and playing, of eating and sleeping, of laughing and loving, but it was all a sham. Dennis was watching her from the doorway now, with that slightly puzzled expression, the helpless look of a person who watches another drowning and is powerless to give aid. Samantha turned away quickly. "Ready in 2 minutes," she said, and he turned back into the bedroom to finish dressing. She flipped the waffles onto a plate and poured a fresh batch of batter. Beside her, the telephone rang, and she sucked her fingers clean and picked it up with a free hand. "Sam Silver," she said. "Thank God. I've been going out of my mind. What happened to you, darling?" Her knees went rubbery under her, and she had to sit down quickly on one of the stools. "Samantha, can you hear me?" She opened her mouth, but no sound came out. "Tell me what's happening." She could see his face before her, clearly. Each detail of it so vividly remembered. The clear green eyes below the heavy brow, the line of cheekbone and jaw, and the sound of his voice made her shiver. "Samantha, how is your wife, Nicholas?" she asked softly, and he broke off. She held the receiver to her ear with both hands. The silence lasted only a few beats of her heart, but it was long enough. Once or twice, in moments of weakness during the last 2 weeks, she had tried to convince herself that it was not true, that it had all been the viciousness of a lying woman. Now she knew beyond any question that her instinct had been correct. His silence was the admission, and she waited for the lie that she knew would come next. "Would it help to tell you I love you?" he asked softly. And she could not answer. Even in her distress, she felt the rush of relief. He had not lied. At that moment, it was the most important thing in her life. He had not lied. She felt it begin to tear painfully, deep in her chest. Her shoulders shook spasmodically. "I'm coming to get you," he said into the silence. "I won't be here," she whispered. But she felt it welling up into her throat uncontrollably. She had not wept before. She had kept it all safely bottled away. But now, the first sob burst from her, and with both hands, she slammed the telephone back onto its cradle. She stood there still, shaking wildly, and the tears poured down her cheeks and dripped from her chin. Dennis came into the kitchen behind her, tucking his shirt into the top of his trousers, his hair shiny and wet with the straight lines of the comb through it. "Who was that?" he asked cheerfully, and then stopped aghast. "What is it, love?" He started forward again. "Come on now. Don't touch me, please," she whispered huskily, and he stopped again uncertainly. "We're fresh out of milk," she said without turning. "Will you take the van down to the shopping center?" By the time Dennis returned, she was dressed, and she had rinsed her face and tied a scarf around her head like a gypsy. They chewed cold and appetizing waffles in silence until she spoke. "Dennis, we've got to talk."
No. He smiled at her. It's all right, Sam. You don't have to say it. I should have moved on days ago anyway.
Thanks, she said.
It was Nicholas, wasn't it?
She regretted having told him now, but at the time it had been vitally necessary to speak to somebody. She nodded, and his voice had a sting to it as he went on. I'd like to bust that bastard in the mouth. We leveled the score, didn't we? She smiled. But it was an unconvincing smile, and she didn't try to hold it. Sam, I want you to know that for me, it was not just another quick shack job. I know that. Impulsively, she reached out and squeezed his hand. And thanks for understanding. But is it okay if we don't talk about it anymore? Peter Berg had twisted round in his safety straps so that he could press his face to the round Perspex window in the fuselage of the big Sikorsky helicopter. The night was completely, utterly black. Across the cabin, the flight engineer stood in the open doorway, the wind ripping at his bright orange overalls, fluttering them around his body, and he turned and grinned across at the boy. Then he made a wind-milling gesture with his hand and stabbed downwards with his thumb. It was impossible to speak in the clattering, rushing roar of wind and engine and rotor. The helicopter banked gently, and Peter gasped with excitement as the ship came into view. She was burning all her lights. Tier upon tier, the brilliantly lit floors of her stern quarters rose above the altitude at which the Sikorsky was hovering, and seemed to reach ahead to the black horizon. The tank deck was outlined with the rows of hooded lamps, like the street lamps of a deserted city. She was so huge that she looked like a city. There seemed to be no end to her, stretched to the horizon and towering into the sky. The helicopter sank in a controlled sweep towards the white circular target of the heliport, guided down by the engineer in the open doorway. Skillfully, the pilot matched his descent to the forward motion of the ultra-tanker, 22 knots at top economical. Peter had swatted the figures avidly, and the deck moved with grudging majesty to the send of the tall Cape Rollers, pushing in unchecked from across the length of the Atlantic Ocean. The pilot hovered, judging his approach against the brisk northwesterly crosswind, and from 50 feet, Peter could see that the decks were almost level with the surface of the sea, pressed down deeply by the weight of her cargo. Every few seconds, one of the rollers that raced down her length would flip aboard and spread like spilled milk, white and frothy in the deck lights, before cascading back over the side. Made arrogant and unyielding by her vast bulk, the Golden Dawn did not woo the ocean, as other ships do. Instead, her great blunt bows crushed the swells, churning them under or shouldering them contemptuously aside. Peter had been around boats since before he could walk. He too was a sea creature. But though his eye was keen, it was as yet unschooled, so he did not notice the working of the long, wide deck. Sitting beside Peter on the bench seat, Duncan Alexander knew to look for the movement in the hull. He watched the hull twisting and hogging, but so slightly, so barely perceptibly, that Duncan blinked it away and looked again. From bows to stern, she was a mile and a half long, and in essence, she was merely four steel pods held together by an elaborate flexible steel scaffolding, and driven forward by the mighty propulsion unit in the stern. There was small independent movement of each of the tank pods, so the deck twisted as she rolled, and flexed like a longbow as she took the swells under her. The crest of these swells were a quarter of a mile apart. At any one time, there were four separate wave patterns beneath Golden Dawn's hull, with the peaks thrusting up
and the troughs allowing the tremendous dead weight of her cargo to push downwards. The elastic steel groaned and gave to meet these shearing forces. No hull is ever completely rigid, and elasticity has been a part of the ultra-tanker's original design. But those designs had been altered. Duncan Alexander had saved almost 2,000 tons of steel by reducing the stiffening of the central pillar that docked the four pods together. And he had dispensed with the double skins of the pods themselves. He had honed Golden Dawn down to the limits at which his own architects had balked. Then he had hired Japanese architects to rework the designs. They had expressed themselves satisfied that the hull was safe, and had also respectfully pointed out that nobody had ever carried 1 million tons of crude petroleum in a single cargo before. The helicopter sank the last few feet and bumped gently onto the insulated green deck, with its thick coat of plasticized paint, which prevented the striking of spark. Even a grain of sand trodden between leather sole and bare steel could ignite an explosive air and petroleum gas mixture. The ship's party swarmed forward, doubled under the swirling rotor. The luggage in its net beneath the fuselage was dragged away, and strong hands swung Peter down onto the deck. He stood blinking in the glare of deck lamps and wrinkling his nose at the characteristic tanker stench. It is a smell that pervades everything aboard one of these ships, the food, the furniture, the crew's clothing, even their hair and skin. It is the thin, acrid chemical stench of under-rich fumes vented off from the tanks. Oxygen and petroleum gas are only explosive in a mixture within narrow limits. Too much oxygen makes the blend under-rich, and too much petroleum gas makes it over-rich, either of which mixtures are non-explosive, non-combustible. Chantal Alexander was handed down next from the cabin of the helicopter, bringing an instant flash of elegance to the starkly lit scene of bleak steel and ugly functional machinery. She wore a cat suit of dark green with a bright Jean Patou scarf on her head. Two ship's officers closed in solicitously on each side of her and led her quickly away towards the towering stern quarters, out of the rude and blustering wind and the helicopter engine roar. Duncan Alexander followed her down to the deck, shook hands quickly with the first officer. "Captain Randall's compliments, sir. He is unable to leave the bridge while the ship is in the inshore channel." "I understand." Duncan flashed that marvellous smile. The great ship drew almost 20 fathoms fully laden, and she'd come in very close as was prudent to the mountainous coastline of Good Hope, with its notorious currents and wild winds. However, Chantal Christie must not be exposed to the ear-numbing discomfort of the helicopter flight for a moment longer than was necessary. And so Golden Dawn had come in through the inner channel, perilously close to the guardian rocks of Robben Island that stood in the open mouth of Table Bay. Even before the helicopter rose and circled away towards the distant glow of Cape Town City under its dark square mountain, the tanker's great blunt bows were swinging away towards the west. And Duncan imagined the relief of Captain Randall as he gave the order to make the offing into the open Atlantic with the oceanic depths under his cumbersome ship. Duncan smiled again and reached for Peter Berg's hand. "Come on, my boy." "I'm all right, sir." Skillfully, Peter avoided the hand and the smile, containing his wild excitement so that he walked ahead like a man without the skipping energy of a little boy. Duncan Alexander felt the customary flare of annoyance. No more than that. Bare anger at this further rejection by Berg's puppy. They were in single file along the steel catwalk with the child leading. He'd never been able to get close to the boy, and he had tried hard in the beginning. Now Duncan stopped his anger with the satisfying memory of how neatly he'd used the child to slap Berg in the face and draw the fangs of his opposition. Berg would be worrying too much about his brat to have time for anything else. He followed Chantel and the child into the gleaming chrome and plastic corridors of the stern quarters. It was difficult to think of decks and bulkheads rather than floors and walls in here. It was too much like a modern apartment block. Even the elevator, which bore them swiftly and silently 5 stories up to the navigation bridge, helped to dispel the feeling of being shipborne. On the bridge itself, they were so high above the sea as to be divorced from it. The deck lights had been extinguished once the helicopter had gone, and the darkness of the night, silenced by the thick double-glazed windows, heightened the peace and isolation. The riding lights in the bows seemed remote as the very stars, and the gentle lulling movements of the immense hull were only just noticeable. The master was a man of Duncan Alexander's own choosing. The command of the flagship of Christie Marine should have gone to Basil Riley, the senior captain of the fleet. However, Riley was Berg's man, and Duncan had used the foundering of Golden Adventurer to force premature retirement on the old sailor. Randall was young for the responsibility, just a little over 30 years of age, but his training and his credentials were impeccable, and he was an honors graduate of the Tanker School in France. Here, top men received realistic training in the specialized handling of these freakish giants in cunningly constructed lakes and scale model harbors, working 30-foot models of the bulk carriers that had all the handling characteristics of the real ships. Since Duncan had given him the command, he had been a staunch ally and had starkly defended the design and construction of his ship when the reporters, whipped up by Nicholas Berg, had questioned him. He was loyal, which weighed heavily, tipping the balance for Duncan against his youth and inexperience. He hurried to meet his important visitors as they stepped out of the elevator into his spacious, gleaming modern bridge. A short, stocky figure with a bull neck and the thrusting heavy jaw of great determination or great stubbornness. His greeting had just the right mixture of warmth and civility, and Duncan noted approvingly that he treated even the boy with careful respect. Randall was bright enough to realize that one day the child would be head of Christie Marine. Duncan liked a man who could think so clearly and so far ahead. But Randall was not quite prepared for Peter Berg. "Can I see your engine room, Captain?"
"You mean right now?"
"Yes." For Peter, the question was superfluous. "If you don't mind, sir," he added quickly. Today was for doing things, and tomorrow was lost in the mists of the future. Right now will be just fine. Well, now, the captain realized the request was deadly serious, and that this lad could not be put off very easily. "We go on automatic during the night. There's nobody down there now, and it wouldn't be fair to wake the engineer, would it? It's been a hard day."
"I suppose not."
Bitterly disappointed, but amenable to convincing argument, Peter nodded. "But I'm certain the chief will be delighted to have you as his guest directly after breakfast." The chief engineer was a Scot, with 3 sons of his own in Glasgow, the youngest of them almost exactly Peter's age. He was more than delighted. Within 24 hours, Peter was the ship's favourite, with his own blue company issue overalls altered to fit him, and his name embroidered across the back by the Lascar steward, Peter Berg. He wore his bright yellow plastic hard hat at the same jaunty angle as the chief did, and carried a wad of cotton waste in his back pocket to wipe his greasy hands after helping one of the stokers clean the fuel filters. The messiest job on board and the greatest fun.
Although the engine control room, with its rough camaraderie, endless supplies of sandwiches and cocoa, and satisfying grease and oil that made a man look like a professional, was Peter's favorite station, yet he stood other watches. Every morning, he joined the first officer on his inspection. Starting in the bows, they worked their way back, checking each of the pod tanks, every valve, and every one of the heavy hydraulic docking clamps that held the pod tanks attached to the main frames of the hull. Most important of all, they checked the gauges on each compartment, which gave the precise indication of the gas mixtures contained in the air spaces under the main deck of the crude tanks. Golden Dawn operated on the inert system to keep the trapped fumes in an over-rich and safe condition. The exhaust fumes of the ship's engine were caught, passed through filters and scrubbers to remove the corrosive sulfur elements, and then, as almost pure carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide, they were forced into the air spaces of the petroleum tanks. The evaporating fumes of the volatile elements of the crude mingled with the exhaust fumes to form an over-rich, oxygen-poor, and unexplosive gas. However, a leak through one of the hundreds of valves and connections would allow air into the tanks, and the checks to detect this were elaborate, ranging from an unceasing electronic monitoring of each tank to the daily physical inspection in which Peter now assisted. Peter usually left the first officer's party when it returned to the stern quarters. He might then pass the time of day with the two-man crew in the central pump room. From here, the tanks were monitored and controlled, loaded and offloaded. The flow of inert gas balanced, and the crude petroleum could be pushed through the giant centrifugal pumps and transferred from tank to tank to make alterations to the ship's trim during partial discharge, or when one or more tanks were detached and taken inshore for discharge. In the pump room was kept a display that always fascinated Peter. In the sample cupboard, with its rows of screw-topped bottles, each containing samples of the cargo taken during loading. As all four of Golden Dawn's tanks had been filled at the same offshore loading point, and all with crude from the same field, each of the bottles bore the identical label: El Barras Crude, Bunkers C, High Cadmium. Peter liked to take one of the bottles and hold it to the light. Somehow, he'd always expected the crude oil to be treacly and tar-like. But it was thin as human blood, and when he shook the bottle, it coated the glass, and the light through it was dark red, again like congealing blood. Some of the crudes are black, some yellow, and the Nigerians are green, the pump foreman told him. This is the first red that I've seen. I suppose it's the cadmium in it, Peter told him. Oh, I guess it is, the foreman agreed seriously. All on board had very soon learned not to talk down to Peter Berg. He expected to be treated on equal terms. By this time, it was mid-morning, and Peter had worked up enough appetite to visit the galley, where he was greeted like visiting royalty. Within days, Peter knew his way unerringly through the labyrinthine and usually deserted passageways. It was characteristic of these great crude carriers that you might wander through them for hours without meeting another human being. With their huge bulk and their tiny crews, the only place where there was always human presence was the navigation bridge on the top floor of the stern quarters. The bridge was always one of Peter's obligatory stops. Good morning, Tug, the officer of the watch would greet him. Peter, being christened with his nickname when he'd announced at the breakfast table on his first morning, "Tankers are great, but I'm going to be a tug captain, like my dad." On the bridge, the ship might be taken out of automatic to allow Peter to spell the helmsman for a while, or he would assist the junior deck officers while they made a sun shot as an exercise to check against the satellite navigational decker. Then, after socializing with Captain Randall for a while, it was time to report to his true station in the engine.
"We were waiting on you, Tug," growled the chief. "Get your overalls on, man. We're going down the propeller shaft tunnel."
The only unpleasant period of the day was when Peter's mother insisted that he scrub off the top layers of grease and fuel oil, dress in his number ones, and act as an unpaid steward during the cocktail hour in the elaborate lounge of the owner's suite. It was the only time that Chantel Alexander fraternized with the ship's officers, and it was a painfully stilted hour, with Peter one of the main sufferers. But the rest of the time, he was successful in avoiding the clinging, restrictive rulings of his mother, and the hated, fiercely but silently resented presence of Duncan Alexander, his stepfather. Still, he was instinctively aware of the new and disturbing tensions between his mother and Duncan Alexander. In the night, he heard the raised voices from the master cabin, and he strained to catch the words. Once, when he heard the cries of his mother's distress, he had left his bunk and gone barefooted to knock on the cabin door. Duncan Alexander had opened it to him. He was in a silk dressing gown, and his handsome features were swollen and flushed with anger. "Go back to bed." "I want to see my mother," Peter had told him quietly.
"You need a damn good hiding," Duncan had flared. "Now do as you're told."
"I want to see my mother." Peter stood his ground, standing very straight in his pajamas, with both his tone and expression neutral. And Chantel had come to him in her nightdress and knelt to embrace him. "It's all right, darling. It's perfectly all right." But she had been weeping, and there had been no more loud voices in the night. However, except for an hour in the afternoon, when the swimming pool was placed out of bounds to officers and crew, while Chantel swam and sunbathed, she spent the rest of the time in the owner's suite, eating all her meals there, withdrawn and silent, sitting at the panoramic windows of her cabin, coming to life only for an hour in the evenings, while she played the owner's wife to the ship's officers. Duncan Alexander, on the other hand, was like a caged animal. He paced the open decks, composing long messages which were sent off regularly over the telex in company code to Christy Main in Leadenhall Street. Then he would stand out on the open wing of Golden Dawn's bridge, staring fixedly ahead at the northern horizon, awaiting the reply to his last telex, chafing openly at having to conduct the company's business at such long remove, and goaded by the devils of doubt and impatience and fear. Often it seemed as though he were trying to forge the mighty hull onwards, faster and faster into the north, by the sheer power of his will.